So when you measure feed efficiency, I think understanding what feeds are driving your feed efficiency up or down, understanding, look at that into the context of what are they costing, right? So don't look at feed efficiency blindly. Track feed efficiency and try to do everything you can nutrition-wise and management-wise to drive it up.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Adiseo USA, producers of SmartAmine M and MilkPay.com. Hi-D from DSM Firmenich can help improve cattle's vitamin D status to deliver higher milk yield and carcass efficiency. Asepsis, an ounce of prevention. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Excellent, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Volac, unlocking ruminant potential through nutritional solutions for a sustainable future.
All right, welcome everybody to this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. I'm your host for this week, Gail Carpenter, State Dairy Extension Specialist with Iowa State University. And I'm joined today by Enrique Skolnick with Progressive Dairy Solutions. He is a dairy nutrition and management consultant with Progressive Dairy. Enrique grew up in Argentina and he moved to the U.S. in 1989. He attended the University of Illinois College of Ag and then the College of Vet Med at University of Illinois as well, graduating in 1998, after which he moved out to California, where he focused on dairy medicine until 2008, when he joined PDS as a nutritionist and management consultant. His group has grown to 52 independent nutrition and management consultants working across the U.S., Latin America, and the Middle East. Enrique is also part owner of Valley Milk of California, a milk powder plant processing around 40 loads of milk a day, and Frio Gelato, retail Argentine gelato stores in Chicago, Evanston, and Wilmette, Illinois. I did not know that about the gelato stores. That's really, how'd you get into the gelato business?
In Buenos Aires, especially my city where I grew up, we're big gelato eaters. You can walk, you know, maybe five blocks in any direction and go to a gelato store. So my cousin and I, my cousin's from Argentina as well, and we said we wanted to bring, you know, Argentine flavored gelato. Obviously, gelato is an Italian, invention, but we wanted to bring Argentine flavor gelato to the United States and share that with our passion for gelato with other people.
Well, I thank you for your service. So, what makes Argentine gelato different than Italian gelato?
It's the same, except we have some typical flavors like dulce de leche is the big one that is awesome, right? And we make all kinds of dulce leche, with chocolate chips and, other things in them. And then we have the typical Italian flavors like Sauvignon and stracciatella and some of the other typical Italian flavors as well. We also make yerba mate, which is kind of our tea in Argentina. So we make that one. We make an avocado flavor too, which is awesome. I know it sounds a little bit kind of out there, but it's really tasty, so.
Yeah. I was going to say, as soon as I was like, oh, you got to have a mate flavor if it's Argentine.
Yes.
You're one of the few Argentinians I've seen without a mate in your hand. So maybe you've got it in your truck somewhere, but.
Yes. When I go out to Argentina, I get, my parents still drink a lot of mate, so I get to drink a lot when I'm down there. Yeah.
I didn't know you guys were allowed to drink coffee. I thought you had to drink mate.
Yeah. I started drinking coffee when I put a little bit of coffee into my mate, and that's a perfect combination.
Oh.
So put a little bit of ground coffee into your mate. So good.
I will have to try that. I'm a big coffee drinker.
Yes.
But I do like mate. It's pretty good. So I'll have to give that a shot. Yeah. But we came here to talk about dairy cows, not gelato or mate. So I think today we kind of wanted to focus on some topics of feed efficiency in dairy cattle. Feed efficiency is obviously huge, right? I think for a long time we just focused on pounds of milk and pushing the pounds and kind of forgot that we need the inputs as well, too. I always, when I talk to my students, I explain it like gas mileage, right? Like you can... you want to get more miles per gallon out of the cows or if we're in a metric country, liters per 100 kilometers or whatever it is. So it's definitely something that has an impact on a dairy business. Obviously, feed is going to be a huge cost of dairy business, and making sure that we get the most impact out of the pounds of feed that we feed is going to be very influential.
Elevate animal performance with Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition, your trusted ally in excellence. Their high-quality feed ingredients like coated nutrients and fat powders provide ruminants with extra energy, boosting health, productivity, and cost efficiency. Unleash your herd's potential with Berg & Schmidt.
When you talk about feed efficiency, how are you defining it?
So we're looking at intakes, dry matter intakes, divided by the number of pounds that or liters that the cows are producing. So that's the simplest way to do it. Now it's complicated to do it on farm in a do it accurately. So we need to measure refusals and weigh refusals by pen, and we can get, if we measure refusals by pen, then we can get pen feed efficiency, not individual cow feed efficiency. Obviously, we are not able to get, but we can get each individual pen feed efficiency daily. But we have to measure refusals daily in order to accurately measure dry matter intakes. So dry matter intakes and milk production, if you have those two numbers, then you can get your feed efficiency.
Are you ever talking about feed efficiency in terms of energy corrected milk or solids corrected milk or anything like that? Or do you usually focus on that fluid number?
No, please don't use the fluid number, everybody.
Okay.
Only use energy correct.
There you go. Yep.
That's the only way that we can compare, time of the year from time of the year, dairy to dairy, et cetera, is to do energy corrected milk. Yes.
I thought you were saying do fluid milk, and I was like, oh, I don't want to have an argument with a guest.
Yeah, please. No, you got to call me out on those things. Don't hesitate. No, thank you for clarifying. So it's energy corrected milk always. And there's still people that are doing fluid, and that's just not accurate, right? Energy corrected milk is accurate. And there's so many formulas for energy corrected milk. Mm-hmm. And dairy record, there's one formula that is the correct formula. It's the RMS, I think, formula. It's the correct formula. So it takes into account basically how many units of energy are in a butterfat, how many units of energy are in protein, and then it accounts for solids as well. And obviously there's some other minor components in milk, but they're really not very significant as far as figuring in into the energy corrected calculation. But obviously butterfat has a lot of energy. Protein has a lot of energy as well. And those are the two biggest parts of that formula.
Yeah. So we're using energy corrected milk, pounds of dry matter intake. How does this equation influence farm profitability?
Yeah, it's and that's a great question too, because I'm looking, so I'm not only looking at feed efficiency, and you can coin this, I'm looking at money efficiency as well, right? Mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. And this is, you may have more questions after this, but money efficiency and feed efficiency can be different. And sometimes we may feed a feed that costs us a little bit of feed efficiency, but is so much cheaper than a feed that we're substituting, than taking a little hit on feed efficiency, but having a much cheaper cost on that diet. May drive more profits.
Yeah.
Same thing with the value of, you have different digestibility forages. If you feed a low digestibility, low fiber digestibility forage, that drags your feed efficiency down, but it may be so much cheaper than anything else you can feed in that area, in that location, that it may be maybe a good idea to drive that volume or that amount up in the diet, just because you can get more money per pound of milk or per liter of milk.
So are you usually looking at that as income over feed cost?
Yes, and more importantly, profit per cow per year is even better than income over feed cost. So how much profit we make per cow per year.
Yeah.
And driving typically, you know, driving hundredweight sold per dairy unit can really have a huge impact on profits, mm-hmm. because you're more hundredweights shipped per dairy unit, even if it means shipping a little less milk per cow. Sometimes that happens, where, you know, to get sell another 100 pounds of milk, that may mean giving up a little bit of milk, a couple of pounds of milk per cow. But if you can sell more 100 pounds per dairy unit, then your fixed costs that can have a huge impact in your fixed expenses. So you can lower the average cost per hundredweight on your fixed expenses.
Yes. So when you're looking at feed efficiency, do you have, and we'll circle back to the idea of feed efficiency here. Do you have a benchmark that you're trying to get your producers to hit? Do you have targets for feed efficiency that you're working on? And I guess, what are the, like, what's kind of the standard that you want your producers to hit? And then what's a good stretch goal for people as they're looking at feed efficiency?
Yeah. And typically, you know, we feed a lot of forages in certain parts of the country. Mm-hmm. We feed a lot of forages everywhere, really. You know, homegrown feeds are, even though they're more or less expensive in different parts of the country, but they're a great risk management tool, because the cost of those forages don't change that much year to year. I mean, there's some inflation now on the input side on making forages, but typically it's not like, you know, corn can be $150 a ton and then go to $300, right, on a really bad year. Mm-hmm. Forages don't do that. You know, the input cost may go up a little bit year to year, and so if you have that portion of your feed locked up long term, because you own, you know, mm-hmm. your ground and you can make these forages, then it's a great risk management tool, right? So if you feed a lot of forages, depending if you have a very high forage diet, especially, a lot of your feed efficiency is going to be impacted by the digestibility of the NDF of those forages. Mm-hmm. So in a high forage diet, I would probably say that's the number one factor that plays a role in your feed efficiency, is NDF digestibility. If you're in the Midwest or in upstate New York, where you have a lot of rainwater irrigation, right? A lot more temperate weather than in the West Coast, then the NDF digestibility on your corn silage, on your haylages, is going to be excellent. And you can have, you know, 165, 175 feed efficiency. As you move to states where we flood irrigate, your NDF digestibility drops significantly. We have a lot hotter weather here in California, and NDF digestibility is 6-7 TT NDF, the total track NDF digestibility, which is at 240 hour. NDF digestibility starts dropping, and then so in California, for example, if you're above of 1.5, you're doing well. So in the context of the diets that are economical to feed, you know, your feed efficiency goal may be different, right? So if I was improve NDF digestibility in California, I would want a single crop. I want to plant the corn really, really early, so it doesn't get hit with that super hot weather. I would want to do drip irrigation, so it doesn't stress out the plant. Flood irrigation, once it gets a few inches above the base of the plant kind of goes into it gets stressed, and we lose NDF digestibility. So feed efficiency is going to be dependent on all these different factors, different parts of the country. Depending on what diets are economical to feed, we may have different feed efficiency goals.
All right. So I guess that brings me to my next question, which is, so what are some of these low hanging fruits? So we talked about NDF digestibility. Can't always have great control over NDF digestibility every year, right? So we're sometimes at the mercy of weather. But so what are some other top influencers beyond that, in some potential low-hanging fruit that dairy producers could be looking for if they're trying to improve feed efficiency?
The type of byproducts, you know, in California, for example, we feed a lot of byproducts in choosing your byproducts and understanding how they feed. So I think one of the questions that you always ask in these dairy podcasts is, you know, talking about what's your favorite resource, right? For work in, you know, my most used resource probably for the work that I do is NDS, mm-hmm. which is a software program to balance diets. And it's based on CNCPS biology, the Cornell Minor Institute model, mm-hmm. which it's widely regarded as the most accurate model to calculate rumen output. So accurately, if you feed a lot of byproducts like we do in California, testing those byproducts and having good measures, like for example for almond hulls, how many people feed almond hulls, how many nutritionists feed almond hulls, and understand digestibility of almond hulls, right? You're using them to replace corn silage mostly, mm-hmm. and so how do almond hulls compare to corn silage, to California corn silage specifically, in NDF digestibility? In other, you know, do you measure that on a regular basis? So are you using the correct inputs for your byproducts? Mm-hmm. If you're not, then you're not going to get good results feeding byproducts. So if you're using, an Excel sheet to balance diets, I wouldn't recommend that you feed byproducts, because you're not going to be able to accurately load the correct inputs to measure rumen output.
Are there any management strategies we could be looking at beyond just what's in the diet? Is there anything we can do from a management side that will help with feed efficiency?
Absolutely. So in California, it's hot. So heat abatement, you know, maintaining intakes during the summer is people are incredibly successful, surprisingly mm-hmm. successful maintaining intakes now during the summer. You know, some dairies, you know, will give up 1 or 2 pounds of milk during the summer. In some other dairies, we'll give up 10 pounds of milk during the summer. And a lot of that is intake related. We also talk about slug feeding during the summer. Anything that we can do to spread out those meals. So naturally, the cows, when they're hot, you know, they're panting, so they don't want to eat. They'll stand there and pant. So cows are, the rumen is designed for the cow to eat 8 to 12 meals a day. If they start eating 6 meals a day, the rumen doesn't work very well. We see more subclinical acidosis, right? The main source of buffer for the rumen, we used to think that it was, the 60 liters or 80 liters of saliva that the cow makes every day, which is, there's a lot of bicarb in there. But now we know that it's the exchange between volatile fatty acids and bicarb or hydrogen. The VFA is getting absorbed into the body and the hydrogen coming, getting exchanged for that VFA. Mm-hmm. If cows run out of feed, they run out of VFAs and that whole exchange shuts down. Then the cow goes and eats a huge meal and she starts making a massive amount of lactic acid, but the rumen is not buffered anymore because she ran out of feed. And we know that that's a huge cause of acidosis. As a matter of fact, in most research trials, when they challenge cows with an acidosis, they couldn't consistently get an acidosis until they did feed restriction. Right? They could load them up with grain, and they would get acidosis in some of the cows, but not all of them. Until they restricted feed and then loaded them up with grain, then they got acidosis in 100% of the cows. So mm-hmm. So running out of feed is it's a huge risk. So keeping your feed consumption during the summer, that really helps your feed efficiency. Keeping the rumen pH consistent throughout the day. So even in the, whether it's summer or winter, not having slug, you know, eliminating slug feeding, it's going to be keep your cow more feed efficient. You need to keep that bug population alive and in large numbers, you know, so that they can get the most out of the feed that you put in that rumen. So anything that lowers that bacteria population, that biomass in the rumen, it's going to cost you feed efficiency. So for some of the dairymen that like to run cows really short in feed, there's an opportunity there. You know, I'm not saying you can't make money, feeding to a slick bunk, but you can make more money by not shorting the cows.
Yeah. I'd probably add repro to your list too, right? The cows that are not very long days in milk are going to be more feed efficient too. If we can keep, and that tends to be a little bit cyclical, right? So if repro slips and they get long days in milk, they get, it's easy for those cows to get over conditioned. They're going to have a harder time calving back in. They're going to have a harder time getting rebred. It's kind of a positive feedback loop there a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So adding to feed management, reproduction is huge. Every 10 days where you go up or down is going to cost your, in days in milk for the herd, it's going to cost you 2.5 pounds of milk approximately, depending on what your average production is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's dairies that you see, they range, depending on how consistent their preg rate is, they may range, the best dairies, they can get down to a 10-day range, so 2.5 pounds only. There's other dairies that they take a huge hit at certain times of the year, and they range 40 days, so that's 10 pounds of milk. So they're going to, dairies that that go from, 150 to 190, they have that 40 days, that's 10 pounds of milk. I have dairies that the lowest point is 150 and highest is 160, and those guys, they
wow.
don't fluctuate in I see less of a fluctuation in feed efficiency and in production throughout the year. And remember, if you lose 10 pounds of milk, that's your cash flow. You just lost over 10% of your cash flow, depending on how much milk you're making.
Yeah, especially challenging, I'm sure, out in places like California where you're fighting heat stress when it comes to getting cows bred too.
Yeah, that's where usually 9 months after July is when we see the highest days of milk, right? So that's April.
Yep.
We may see the highest days of milk. And then our best breeding months, 9 months after, December, February, March. 9 months after that, we see the best days of milk of the year. But yeah, if you can have that narrow days of milk throughout the 12 months, and that's all goes back to how efficient you are getting cows pregnant during the more challenging times, which is the summer. So don't stop breeding cows in the summer. And there's some things that you can do during the summer to improve your reproduction program.
Talk to me more about byproduct feeding. We obviously, California is kind of the gold standard when it comes to byproduct feeds and how many byproduct feeds and you guys have available. I took Dairy Challenge this past year, was out in California, and I think my Midwestern students were a little bit surprised by what some of the rations looked like out there. Because you just have such a diverse industry in general. And so many byproduct feeds available. What lessons can the rest of the country learn from California about byproduct feeding?
If you're feeding byproducts, the step number one is accurately describing the nutrients that are in those byproducts and having a program that allows you to load all that information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then other huge consideration is how consistent is the byproduct day to day. You have to measure that with quality control, with frequent testing and understanding whatever plant is putting out the byproduct, how consistent the plant is. If it's not consistent, sometimes they're not worth feeding. And that's just a reality, or if it's less consistent, maybe it's not milk cow feed, it's maybe a heifer feed. They don't take as, they're not as sensitive as a milk cow. And then looking at how digestible they are, being able to measure this. So we do a lot of, I do a lot of wet chemistry on a lot of the byproducts, and it's an expensive thing to do. But unless you're doing wet chemistry, don't do NIR and expect to get accurate results on byproducts.
Yeah, especially for the weird feeds. They're not, the calibration curves aren't as robust. Yeah.
Yeah, or they may not even be there, right? I mean, yeah, so.
Right, right.
Yeah, including dry matter consistency, you know, having a good description of those byproducts and consistency.
All right. Well, we are we're starting to get close to time here. Is there any other last words of wisdom on this topic that you want to feed efficiency, byproduct feeds, gelato? any other final thoughts before we move on to our three questions?
Yeah, just take things into context. So when you measure feed efficiency, I think understanding what feeds are driving your feed efficiency up or down, and then understanding, look at that into the context of what are they costing, right? So don't look at feed efficiency blindly. Track feed efficiency and try to do everything you can nutrition-wise and management-wise to drive it up, but don't give up profits to solely to drive feed efficiency, right? Sometimes there may be cases where feeds are so expensive, feeds are going to give you higher feed efficiency are so expensive that they're cost prohibitive or are going to drive your cost per hundredweight up. And then, you know, a whole topic that we didn't discuss is obviously amino acid balancing, and that has allowed us also to drive as a driver of better money efficiency, right?
All right. Well, if there's anywhere that people can go to kind of keep up on what you're working on or stay in touch?
Yeah, I mean, I have often both producers and nutritionists from different parts of the world. You know, obviously I'm from Argentina, so a lot of guys. I get people that ride along with me sometimes. A lot of our team members and myself, you know, we sometimes have an article on different topics. Our website has a lot of resources too. That www.progressivedairysolutions.com has a lot of resources. They can go there as well. And yeah, just, you know, I would say keep looking for, you know, the Cornell Dairy symposiums and conferences. And because I'm a big participant in ABP, the American Association of Bovine Practitioners. I take a lot of classes and learn a lot of things from my colleagues there. And same thing from the people from Cornell University and as well as Iowa with Lance Baumard a lot of people that helped me so much over the years.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Trow Nutrition, North America. Everything we do is driven by passion and backed by science. Feed solutions that surpass expectations. Learn more about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/feed. That's schooler.com/feed. Our Yeast 40, ruminal and intestinal double modulation by ICC Animal Nutrition. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Diamond V, because animal health deserves a healthier approach. Your partner for extra animal performance, Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition. Typical fresh cow incidence of clinical hypocalcemia is 3 to 6%, while subclinical hypocalcemia affects 50% or more mature cows. Based on cutting-edge research, Exelite offers a new approach that is build-effective and the ZDUs. For more information, visit www.protecta.com.
Well, we can go in and ask you our three questions that we ask all of our guests then in that case. So as you're aware, the first question that all of our guests get asked is, what is your favorite dairy-related book or resource? And I think you mentioned this already, but we'll say it again. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. So my number one would be NDS. You know, I'm NDS is a software program that uses the CNCPS biology to estimate rumen output. And it's a great program. There's also another one that some people in our group use that is AMTS. So that would be my number one resource. I use it all the time, and before I was using NDS, I was using a different software program, which basically had an Excel sheet on steroids, and it was okay, right? I mean, it was it allowed me to do a decent job, but the CNCPS biology really allows us to have a much, much better understanding of what the rumen is going to do for us, what it's going to produce. So yeah, that will be my number one. I still have a bunch of veterinary books that I refer to all the time, you know, Smith and Blood and Rattlestitz. I still go back, and Pasquini's, they have a little, there's a little booklet. I don't know if it's probably not made anymore, but a little booklet, a quick reference for diseases.
Okay. So the next question we ask is, what is your favorite non-dairy related book or resource?
So the one I'm super excited about right now is it's a book called Outlive by Peter Attia.
Oh.
And he's an MD and researcher, and talks about longevity in humans.
Oh.
And includes a lot of physiology and a lot of kind of the latest research on longevity. And some of the things that you can do lifestyle wise to increase longevity, and even now some people are taking there's a molecule called mTOR, and it's a cellular down regulator and it helps with increased longevity in people. So there's a drug, it's called rapamycin, that is a mTOR down regulator, and people are taking it successfully. That's something that's interesting.
Hmm.
There's some other things that impact your how high your glycemic peaks are after a meal, basically that restrict your carbohydrate intakes after meals. That's shown to promising as far as increasing or lowering your risk for different diseases that shorten longevity. But the most interesting concept in that book is Peter Attia calls it the squaring of the longevity curve. So a typical curve in a Western country with our Western diets, you know, you you have a kind of a long-term decline of your health, you know, over years, you know, with cardiovascular disease, et cetera, other ailments that are related to longevity. And so you have a long-term decrease of your health.
Hmm.
And so a lot of people die with poor health. And the squaring of the curve, you know, he calls it square. You got to square your curve. So you hit your longevity, then you plateau and you stay straight. And then one day you die, you know, so you die with a higher quality of life. So
that's
interesting to look at it that way, right? How do you square your longevity curve? What are the things that are going to help you square your longevity curve?
Interesting. Huh. And you said that one's called Outlive?
Yeah, Outlive by Peter Attia. He has a really great podcast. And Hyman is another guy that has a podcast. And I think those two work together. But yeah, that book is a great way to get started, you know, understanding some of these physiological concepts of what are the impacts, the negative impacts on our long-term health.
All right. And the last question that all of our guests get is, what do you think sets successful dairy professionals apart from those that are not successful?
Yeah, I think the number one, staying ahead of the rest with education. You know, education is a never ending. And one of my professors in veterinary school, he told me, hey, the day that that you think you know it all, then that's the day you should retire. Right. So,
yep.
Constantly trying to learn more, being curious about new things,
Yeah.
I think that's really important. And yeah, how you treat your clients, I think it's another one. Your clients want to know that they're number one. They're the most important thing in your professional life. It's super important to be successful.
All right. Wise words to end on. And with that, we will go ahead and let you go. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today on this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show.
Thank you for having me.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.